Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Monday, everyone. Innovation. It's what many say Michigan needs to become a player in the global economy. On today's program, we look at the most innovative companies in our state. What are they doing differently in a post-Great Recession economy? Then we travel to Muskegon, a community that continues to be plagued by gun violence. Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project will report. But first, donations to Governor Rick Snyder's Civic Fund decreased last year, and decreased by a lot. The 501c4, known as the New Energy to Reinvent and Diversify Fund, or NERD Fund for short, received $1.3 million in 2011. But in 2012, the donations shrank to $368,000. As our next guest, Jonathan Osting, a reporter for MLive, reports, quote, the NERD Fund earns tax-exempt status by purporting to promote charitable causes, including lessening the financial burdens of government in the state of Michigan. Well, let's talk NERD Fund now. Jonathan, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
So for folks that say what, NERD Fund, what is this? Give us some background on just exactly what it is.
Sure. Well, the NERD Fund was set up shortly after the governor took office. And as you mentioned, the idea is that he would raise money for this fund to lessen the financial burdens of government. In other words, to pay for some things that taxpayers might otherwise cover. For instance, it does pay for some very good things like the team that travels with the governor to public events. The NERD Fund is used to pay some of their transportation costs. Or the governor's office in Lansing is now live streaming events online. The NERD Fund helps pay for those streaming costs. So it is used up, it is set up to spend money on things that maybe the state government would like to do but can't necessarily afford to do in the current financial climate.
And the thing that I think a lot of us have caught in the discussions about the NERD Fund is the fact that it can collect unlimited contributions from anonymous donors. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. Any 501c4 can. Unlimited and anonymous donors. So that's pretty typical. And the governor is not the only person that has one of these 501c4s. The only politician that has one of these 501c4s set up. But this case is a little unique because it's also been disclosed that he's using this NERD Fund to pay the salary of one of his top advisors. So a guy who's actually in the executive offices here in downtown Lansing and has an office right next to the governor's is being paid by this fund. In other words, he's being paid by anonymous donors.
And how much is he being paid?
It's $100,000 a year, which to me, as a reporter, is a lot of money. I will say Rich Baird, his transformation manager, was probably making considerably more in the private sector. He worked at, I believe it was PricewaterhouseCoopers, but has joined the governor for $100,000 a year as a close advisor.
And I guess, again, just considering that the money comes from anonymous donors and we have a governor who is pledging transparency, do those two things seem at odds?
Well, there certainly seems to be a little bit of a conflict there. The governor points out, and rightly so, that he is following all the laws with relation to this fund. He's certainly disclosing all the information that is required legally. The question is, of course, if you're paying somebody in your office who's being involved in policy decisions, whether the governor should go above and beyond that and sort of indicate who's helping to pay the salary of this transformation manager.
And what kind of money are we talking about with payouts? You know, you mentioned there's travel expenses and management fees and the like. What kind of coin is going into all of those from the NERD Fund?
This year, there's $173,000. In 2012, there's $173,000 spent on travel expenses, $124,000 on management fees, and most of that, I believe, is Mr. Baird's contract or salary. There's about $100,000 spent on office expenses, $49,000 on conferences, and $30,000 is also paid out to a fundraising organization to go out and solicit new donations for this NERD Fund.
And as you pointed out, this is not an unusual thing. I think you found one that on the other side of the coin, Senator Democratic Leader Gretchen Whitmer has her Move Michigan Forward organization.
Yeah, Move Michigan Forward is actually a nonprofit that I believe actually predates Senator Whitmer, but it's currently run by a staffer in her office, and it's used to pay for things like food and beverages in the leadership office, or even food for some of the legislators on the floor during session if it's a particularly long day. So again, the idea is to, you know, spend some money so that taxpayer funds don't need to be used in those instances. And it certainly happens more often than most people probably realize.
So as we take a look at what we talked about right at the very top of this interview, Jonathan Osting, as you've been reporting on MLive, that contributions took a nose plant basically between 2011 and 2012, almost a 75% drop in contributions to the NERD fund. Do we have any ideas why?
No clear ideas. Nobody wanted to specifically say why the funds dropped. It's important to note, I did point out that this fund has been under some fairly intense public scrutiny in recent months. However, that scrutiny didn't really start until the end of 2012, so it's hard to ascribe the drop in fundraising specifically to scrutiny. It could simply be it was the governor's second year in office, giving was just down as a matter of routine that year. It's hard to say. Or people may have been donating money to, the political action committee instead. There's certainly a lot of ways to spend money in the political sphere.
Well, this was Intro to Nerd Fund 101. We appreciate the coursework here, Jonathan Osting, Capital Reporter for MLive.com. Thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside, and keep an eye on the Nerd Fund for us.
All right. Thanks for having me, Cindy.
So, investors, who's willing to bite? Who's willing to buy bonds from a troubled school district being run by an emergency manager, located in a city run by an emergency manager, a city that just made history with its bankruptcy filing? Well, it's easy to understand why investors may run the other way from the Detroit Public Schools bond offering tomorrow. But my next guest says, hold on, not so fast. He's a municipal bond portfolio manager who thinks the DPS bond offering tomorrow has something to interest an investor. Josh Gons is with Thornburg Investment Management, based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, nice to be here.
Well, what is it that you think, despite the emergency manager and Detroit's bankruptcy, this DPS bond offering could be worth looking at?
Well, this deal is attracting a great deal of attention from investors like myself, and I run about $10 billion in municipal bond assets at Thornburg. And the reason we're interested is there are a couple things that make it attractive. First, it's paying an enormous yield, 4.5% to 5% for a one-year maturity, which is unheard of. There's nothing else like this in the market. The bond is not a credit of the school district. The credit is backed by state aid withholding. The trustee for the bonds has the right to intercept the state aid payments to the school district. So we have a lien, and we step in first and are paid first based on the state's payments. So it's really a state credit. So the bonds were able to get an SP1 rating from S&P, which is a pretty high rating. It's the second highest rating for short-term bonds. So the combination of the extraordinarily high amount of yield with the fairly believable, decent credit story makes it something we have to look at, although I actually haven't yet made my decision about whether we're going to buy this bond when it comes to market tomorrow.
And you're saying it's issued for just 1 year, right?
That's right. It's a one-year maturity, which is a very short maturity. Mm-hmm. Bonds get issued anywhere from 1 year to 30 years. This is a one-year bond. It matures in August 2014.
Yeah, it's not just Detroit. Of course, we've seen Stockton, California, and Jefferson County, Alabama. So it would be understandable that investors would have perhaps a queasy feeling about municipal bonds, particularly a Detroit-related bond, isn't there?
Of course, it would be understandable, and we're just as uncomfortable with credit risk as any investor. However, when there's bad news in the newspapers, often that represents a good opportunity to get involved. We want to make sure we don't miss an opportunity here for a perfectly good bond that just has a bad name stamped on the cover page.
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is some investors' queasiness could open up opportunities for folks with cooler heads.
That is exactly correct. Whenever somebody else is panicking, we want to make sure that we're not panicking, and that if they are throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that we're there to catch the baby.
What would it take you to make that buy decision?
Well, let's see. So There are a number of other issues that I haven't mentioned yet that we're looking at, and that is, for example, what if enrollment in the school district were to continue collapsing? And, it's come down by an enormous amount in the last 10 years. Enrollment is the key to the state aid payments. The state pays roughly $6,000 a year per student. So we have to run a model that'll calculate what happens if enrollment continues to decline. Another thing we have to ask ourselves is, so the city may go Chapter 9, but the school district hasn't yet declared Chapter 9 bankruptcy. But what if it does? Would that cause an acceleration of the other debt? There's already some other debt outstanding backed by state aid withholding. What would happen if the school district declared Chapter 9, all of the other debt got accelerated, meaning it was immediately due and payable, and would there be enough state aid payments to cover all the debt? And then there's just the headline risk. Of course, we're aware that if we were to own this bond in our mutual funds, that some newspaper could publish an editorial saying, or an article saying, Thornburg owns XYZ bond, and some people might get scared, and we have to be sensitive to what's called headline risk. Even though there's nothing wrong with a bond, sometimes you don't want to own it just because it's a bad word, it's a contaminated name. And of course, we're extremely acutely aware of all those Chapter 9s and other bad stories. There are over 60,000 issuers in the bond market, in the municipal bond market, and the vast majority of them are perfectly fine. There are pockets here and there that are in real bad shape, and we do want to avoid that. We've done an extremely good record. We have no defaults in any of our mutual funds. We've done very well, and we want to keep that good record going.
Josh Gons with Thornburg, based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, giving potential investors something to think about with the DPS bond offering tomorrow. The DPS offering is by the Michigan Financial Authority. Josh, thanks for talking with us today.
You're very welcome.
Still ahead, there's so much talk about revitalizing Michigan, trying to get away from our 20th century economic model. Coming up in 20 minutes, we look at what businesses are doing to innovate in our state. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio, and I'm Cynthia Canty. When you ever talk about the outdoor offerings of Pure Michigan, you just cannot overlook her rivers. For every person who can't wait to get to the lake and put in the boat and go sailing or water skiing, there's someone else who can't wait to get to the river and put that paddle into the water. Some of my best memories of Michigan summer were the days that I spent canoeing the Manistee River, thanks to the little cottage my family had right along the river's banks, not too far from Kalkaska. The Bible for Michigan paddlers is, without a doubt, the book Canoeing Michigan Rivers by Jerry Dennis and Craig Date. It was first published in 1986, and now they've released the updated edition of Canoeing Michigan Rivers. Jerry Dennis joins us now from Traverse City. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Cindy.
So when your book crossed my desk, I opened it up, and I went right back in my mind to the Manistee. And there, when I opened it up, you had it, my stretch, the 9.5 miles. It was 3.5 to 5 hour stretch between the CCC Bridge and the Lower Sharon Bridge. And it took me right back to 1971. We would put in at the CCC Bridge and just work our way down, my brothers and me, and wave at my folks as we went by the cottage. And they knew when we went by the cottage, an hour later, my dad would be there at the Lower Sharon Bridge to pick us up. Great, great memories.
That's a great stretch of river. It's one of my favorites.
You guys literally paddled every stretch of every river you write about?
Yeah, about 1,500 miles of them. Actually, more than that, because we paddled over 50 rivers, and we winnowed the final list down to our 45 favorites.
So these are your favorites, but there are even more rivers. It's just amazing to think about. We focus so much on the lakes. What do you think is special and different about the Michigan River experience as compared to the lake experience?
You know, Michigan rivers are quite unique. I've fished and paddled on rivers all over North America and around the world, and I always come back to Michigan with new appreciation for them. Partly it has to do with the vegetation. You know, in the north especially, the cedar sweepers that we call them, leaning over the rivers, give them a real unique character. They keep the rivers cool and shaded, and have a real distinctive north woods look and smell. It's just a wonderful smell.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot of it has to do, too, with our soil, the sand and gravel and rocks in the whole state, and it varies a lot. It's very different in southern Michigan. It's very different in the UP. but it gives the rivers a lot of integrity. The water tends to be a little more stable than many places, you know, because the sandy soil absorbs rainfall instead of it all running off real quickly like it does in the West, for instance.
Mm.
And that helps keep these rivers stable, and the spring water that feeds them tends to be clean and pure and cold.
That it is, as I remember us dipping into the river and swimming right there by the cottage. Or we just jump in as we went down, because that stretch was very conducive to somebody staying in the canoe and somebody else splashing around and having a good time. Your book first came out in 1986, Jerry Dennis. And well, as you revisited Michigan's rivers for this new edition, what's your verdict? How are they holding up?
You know, it's really positive. They are holding up very well. One of the things that has struck me over the years, because I write about water issues of all kinds. I've done a whole lot of work about the Great Lakes and the whole Great Lakes Basin. And, you know, when you cover the Great Lakes, there's a lot of scary news.
Yes.
The rivers are doing well. And the primary reason I think they're doing so well is because so many people have become involved in protecting them and restoring them and cleaning them. When we were doing the research for this book in the mid-'80s, the rivers in southeast Michigan were in terrible shape. It was very discouraging, the Raisin, the Clinton, the Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
We had thought we wanted to paddle those rivers, include them in the book, but we just couldn't do it. They were just too polluted, and we just decided in the end that we couldn't. Well, now there are real active groups of paddlers who paddle those rivers every day, and who work very hard to keep them clean. And it's been a real revolution, I think. The Rouge is a really good example. They started in the headwaters, cleaning the creeks that fed the river, and then gradually worked their way downstream. And now it's a river that we would include in the book. You know, we may add those rivers to a future edition because they have come so far.
So it's really a grassroots involvement of the people living around the rivers and caring about them, banding together.
It's exactly right. You know, one of the keys I always listen for when I'm talking to people about their waters, whether it's the Great Lakes or their local river, is they always use the personal pronoun. They say, my river, my lake. You know, my Lake Michigan, you hear a lot in northwest Michigan. But I hear that all over the state. People say, oh, yeah, I paddled my river today. I bet you grew up thinking that about the Manistee.
Yeah,
it was yours.
That's true.
There's a real personal connection, and that is why people get adamant about keeping them protected and clean.
As you updated your book, Canoeing Michigan Rivers, what changes did you see, Jerry, in the way that people are enjoying the rivers in 2013, perhaps then, compared to the mid-'80s?
Well, the biggest change is kayaks. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, it was very unusual to see a kayak in the river. The only exception were whitewater rivers. We did a lot of whitewater paddling in the western UP, where there's, you know, truly world-class whitewater. And kayakers from all over North America would come to those rivers. In fact, we were among the few who paddled them in open canoes. Mm-hmm. But now the kayak has become the dominant boat on most rivers, and there's good reasons for that. They're easy to handle. They tend to be solo. There are tandem kayaks as well, but most people are in a solo kayak, which gives them a lot of mobility and freedom. And they're less expensive by and large than a canoe, so it's a smaller investment. You can get it. You can jump in the river. if we were doing the book, the original book, now we'd probably call it Paddling Michigan Rivers because so many people are kayaking.
Of course, there's always a good old inner tube, too, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of those as well, absolutely.
What about you? What has changed in the way that you've seen and experienced the rivers in the nearly three decades since you first paddled around Michigan?
Well, you have to remember that when we did the book originally, we were puppies. We were in our late 20s. And we were full of energy, and we just were in love with adventure, and we wanted white water, and we wanted overnight expeditions, and we wanted to get caught in storms, and we did all those things, lots of them. And I've slowed down a little. I admit it. These days, I'm much more content to drift with the current and watch the scenery going by and relax, take my time.
What's your top three canoeing spots?
Wow, that's a.
It's like asking you to pick your favorite child, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. The analogy really is pretty good. I have to say that the Boardman is my favorite river because I grew up on it or near it, and grew up. I learned to paddle and fish on it, and it's real close to my heart.
It's your river, like you say.
Yeah,
we all have
exactly.
Our river. Yeah.
Yep. I think in the Upper Peninsula, my favorite's the Paint River. That's over by Crystal Falls area in the western third of the state, and I love it because it's quick, but it's also a good safe river most of the way for average skills in a paddler. But it goes through great country and it's beautiful, so it's a really good choice for overnight trips for two to seven nights if you wanted to really stretch it out. And there's a beautiful stretch of rapids right about in the middle of the best stretch of river, which has great campsites, just natural campsites under the pines among the rocks by the rapids. Great place to sleep. You can really imagine that you're camping in a place that's been camped in for thousands of years, because everybody would have to portage those rapids, especially in a birch bark canoe.
Sure.
And third one, boy, I that one varies. It depends the day when I'm asked the question, probably. But I would have to say the Manistee. And the reason is because so much of it flows through public land. So you can camp along the way. You can stop anywhere you want for the most part. There's long stretches with houses and cottages. But
sure.
There's a lot of state forest and national forest down below as well.
Well, the book is Canoeing Michigan Rivers. This is the third edition. It's totally revised and updated by Jerry Dennis and Craig Date, looking at 45 rivers in Michigan. And Jerry Dennis spoke to us from Traverse City. It makes me want to head back up there and get back out there. But, of course, you got to bring your bug spray because those black flies can be a pest in the middle of the summer.
That's the truth.
Jerry, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Cindy. Thank you.
And speaking of Michigan rivers, a team with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will estimate the abundance of sea lamprey in the Detroit River this month. They want to determine what control measures might be needed. The eel-like lamprey, you'll recall, invaded the Great Lakes during the 1920s and has stayed there ever since. Lampreys attach to fish using their mouth resembling a suction cup. Their sharp teeth dig through a fish's scales and skin and feed on blood and body fluids. The average lamprey can destroy up to 40 pounds of fish. Crews have kept lamprey numbers under control by applying a specially designed poison to streams where they lay their eggs. Their larvae remain there for several years before becoming adults and swimming to the lakes. The assessment is scheduled for next week. Last month, a disagreement on a residential street in Muskegon turned into a gun battle. Six men were armed, dozens of shots sprayed in all directions. At the house directly behind the gunfight, three children played on a porch, and one woman ran into the line of fire to try and save them. Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity team brings us the story of just what happened that day and the neighborhoods in Muskegon that continue to be plagued by gun violence. The story begins on Monroe Avenue the evening of July 9th.
It wasn't quite yet dinner time. 10-year-old Brooklyn Ridge was walking her dog Scruffy up to the painted white front porch of a gray house on Monroe. Her friends Cameron and Caden were there. Her brother was inside. Behind her in the street, a group of men were fighting. The fight got worse.
They started off as punching and screaming, then they ended up as a gun battle.
Heather Tanner, Cameron and Caden's mom, was inside the house.
I was in my bedroom in the house.
What was the first thing that caught your attention?
A bullet coming into my mattress, through my walls of the house.
Brooklyn's parents, Jim and Shannon Ridge, were in their second floor apartment around the corner when they first heard the shots. Before they could even get down the steps of their apartment, dozens of shots had been fired.
It's basically a war zone, you know. That's how many rounds went off.
27-year-old Carmisha Rogers was on a balcony directly above the kids when the guns came out. The gunmen were in the street, right in front of the house. The kids were 30 feet away, at most. Rogers tried to yell at them, to tell them to get inside. They didn't move. So Rogers ran down the stairs, putting herself in the line of fire.
And she came and got you on the porch?
Yeah, she pushed us all inside.
Do you remember seeing her, or, I mean, what did she say to you?
She said, "Hurry up, kids, get in the house." And then she started pushing us in.
Bullets zipped past. One of the boys says his hand was grazed.
And did you know at that point what had happened? Did you know if anyone was hurt?
No.
What were you thinking?
That everybody was hurt.
But they weren't. The kids were all safe, every one of them. Carmisha Rogers was not. After she pushed the kids inside the house, a bullet hit Rogers above her right ear. The bullet went into the back of her skull, through her brain, and stopped just behind her right eyebrow. Rogers was on the floor when Heather Tanner came out of her room.
And then that's when I saw Misha laying there. And then I just started screaming because I didn't know what else to do. I was shocked. I thought she was dead.
Rogers' sister performed CPR. Paramedics arrived and rushed Rogers to the hospital.
How you feeling these days?
Kind of tired now, but I'm all right.
I met Carmisha Rogers as she recovered in her room at Hackley Hospital in Muskegon. She was surrounded by humming medical equipment and cellophane balloons. It had been 3 weeks since the shooting. Rogers was still hooked up to feeding tubes. But she could walk. She could talk. Her mother, Leandria Traynor, says it's been an amazing recovery, miraculous considering what the doctor told her to expect.
That night after surgery, he came and told me and my husband that it's touch and go. He said, right now, if she make it up out of here, she going to be a vegetable. You know, there's a good chance she won't make it. And I told him, I didn't want to hear that. I can't believe all that was
that night, under that. When Traynor first saw her daughter, she hardly recognized her under all the tubes and hospital equipment. She fainted at the sight. That first night, no one really knew what led to Rogers getting shot. Rogers couldn't tell the story. Police were still sorting out the details. But what they learned later is that Rogers was not at all in harm's way when the gunfight broke out in front of her house. It took weeks for Rogers to remember what happened. But it came back. She told me she was on a second-floor balcony of the house when the fighting started. She saw the three kids playing on the porch downstairs. She saw guns coming out. She saw that the kids were in the line of fire.
And I was basically watching everything unfold as it was happening. I seen the kids and try to yell at them at the top of the steps, but they weren't. Like my words weren't getting out, so I had to go down there and get them out the way.
Police say at least 6 men were armed during the fight in the middle of the street. As many as 30 rounds went off in all directions.
What were the thoughts in your mind at that point? You knew there were guns going off.
I have a thought. Just get the kids out the way. So I want someone to do that for my kids.
Roger says she remembers pushing the kids into the house. Then things went black. The bullet hit her in the back of the head as she got back into the house.
She's our hero. She saved our children.
Heather Tanner, Shannon, and Jim Ridge. They're just grateful for what Rogers did.
I mean, none of us are rich. None of us have $1 million we can hand her and say thank you, and which I would if I could. But I guess my thank you, in a way, is get it out there nationwide what she did.
Ridge says he knows shootings happen every day in America.
But somebody that does what she did, that's rare in America or anywhere else.
But Carmisha Rogers says she was just being a parent, even though the kids on the porch weren't her kids. Her kids almost lost their mom. But Wednesday, they got their mom back. After more than a month in the hospital, Rogers got to go home, and she hopes to make a full recovery.
That was Dustin Dwyer reporting for Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. After a quick break, Dustin will continue the story with a look at what's being done at the community level to help put a stop to violence in Muskegon. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. We return now to a story out of Muskegon, a gunfight that happened July 9th and the woman who ran right into the line of fire to protect the lives of children. But this was not the only shooting in Muskegon in recent months, so let's broaden our view. Let's look at the dramatic rise of gun crimes across several neighborhoods in Muskegon and just what's being done to stop it. Here again from Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project is Dustin Dwyer.
Muskegon is not the most violent city in Michigan. Statistically, that would be Flint or Saginaw or Detroit. But Muskegon is a relatively small city, only about 38,000 people, and much of the crime is centered in just a few neighborhoods. So people who live in those neighborhoods actually experience a much worse rate of crime. Pick a random person off the street, and they'll know someone who's been affected by gun violence. Like Michael Williams. I caught up with him on Southern Avenue on a sunny Saturday afternoon. He knows two people who've been killed by guns just since May. And he knows a lot of kids getting involved in gangs.
It's certain groups of the kids, you know, certain kids that's in the same area, they don't even want to be involved with that stuff. You know what I mean? And then you got the unfortunate kids, like, no parents. All they see is what they see.
What they see is drugs being sold openly on the street. What they see are a lot of people with guns and a lot of people who can get you a gun.
It's easy for them to get a gun. It's hard for them to stay out of trouble.
Overall crime trends in Muskegon have been going down in recent years, as they have been in most cities. But if you look at statistics released by the Muskegon Police Department, one thing you see is that crimes listed as weapons offenses have gone up dramatically, a 287% rise since 2005. And here again, the crimes are concentrated in certain areas. In the Nelson neighborhood, where the shooting happened on July 9th, weapons offenses are up almost 700% since 2005. Shauna Hunter works at the YMCA just across the highway from the Nelson neighborhood. She recently had a group of kids in a room and asked them about guns.
That question was, how many of you think it's easy to get a gun? And 100% of the children raised their hand. And how many of you have guns in your household? And just about all of them raised their hand.
We're talking about kids, some of whom are only 15 years old. TJ Chappelle, who works with Hunter on youth programs at the Y, says many kids feel pulled into crime by gangs.
We say, you know, well, why do you think they want to be in a gang? What, you know, what feeling do you get from this? And they're like, a lot of people come from one parent households, a lot of these kids, and that one parent is working all the time.
Chappelle says for a lot of kids, what it really comes down to is feeling loved.
The gangs replace that love that they're missing at home. And, you know, it's really tough when, you know, you think about it, because it's almost like a lose-lose type of situation there.
Who cares?
We care!
Who cares?
We care!
Hunter and Chappelle organized a walk to make a show of support for the kids and the families that feel outnumbered by the negative influences in their neighborhood. And yes, a community walk is not going to turn around a crime problem in a matter of days, but it's a symbol. It's something to show that the bad guys don't always get to dictate what happens in a neighborhood or how a neighborhood is seen by the outside. And Michael Williams, he thinks it's a good idea.
This should be done more often. They should have more marches, you know what I mean?
That, and he says getting some of the guns off the street, might not be a bad idea. With State of Opportunity, I'm Dustin Dwyer, Michigan Radio News.
You can hear all of Dustin Dwyer's stories and the stories from the State of Opportunity team online. Just go to MichiganRadio.org and click on the State of Opportunity link. In the years after the Great Recession, there's been lots of talk about revitalizing Michigan, trying to get away from the 20th century economic model, trying to move the state, its residents, its jobs, to the 21st century and beyond. And it's fair to say many would agree that innovation is a vital part of moving Michigan's economy forward. Crain's Detroit Business has come out with a list of the 100 most innovative companies in Michigan. They call it the Michigan Innovative Index. Chad Holcomb is a reporter for Crain's Detroit, and he joins us now from Detroit to explore the list. Hi, Chad.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So first of all, according to Crain's, what makes a business innovative?
Well, we've been interested in this question for years here at Crain's. People and companies innovate and apply for patents for their innovations all the time. But they don't always necessarily have a market-leading innovation. So we kind of were curious to know what companies are sort of breaking new ground where there is possibly the most commercialization potential, the most investment potential in their investments. And so we hired Chicago-based Ocean Tomo, a patent valuation firm, to help us evaluate the companies here in Michigan that are applying regularly and have patents issued each year by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. This was something that has intrigued us for years, and we wanted to see how things were trending. And we noticed that companies in 2012, that was the most recent year we could get a complete year of patent issuances from USPTO, mm-hmm. were innovating a little bit more, and were innovating a little more intelligently in terms of targeting specific industries and targeting specific markets that gave their innovations a higher value.
And you report that the total number of patent applications filed by Michigan companies has been on the rise, but that's not the big news. It seems that the big news is the quality of Michigan patents, and that's how you developed your top 100 list. What makes a high-value quality patent?
Well, there are a number of factors on that, and the Ocean Tomo and other companies like it do this sort of work all the time in terms of evaluating a patent, because for many companies, particularly startup companies that are investing in commercializing a new technology, the value of the company is the value of the patent. It helps during due diligence in an acquisition by a possible investor or an investment by a private equity firm. Evaluating these patents gives them a sense of how much the company is worth, how much its intellectual property is worth, and how much an investment should be, what the size of an investment in the company and the stake that should be acquired in that company would be structured according to that intellectual value. So these things are usually evaluated on a number of things. How much that patent is unique mm-hmm. versus building on previous inventions. There will be references within the patent application to other kinds of intellectual property that it's standing on or building on. And more importantly, how much other subsequent innovations now have to do the same. How much they now reference or go back to evaluate the value of a patent, that particular patent. If it gets a lot of references going forward, that's a pretty good indicator that it's a pretty unique and groundbreaking kind of innovation. And that was one of the things that we had we really wanted to take a look at here.
Why are we seeing an increase, do you think, in the quality of patents in Michigan?
Well, there's been a pressure here within the state, particularly through the last economic downturn and the reorganization of the automotive companies to find value in other industries. We noticed that, while auto dominates in volume, the mm-hmm. number of patents here in Michigan, it doesn't necessarily always dominate the value index of patents that were awarded in the last several years. Now, these were patents that get awarded in 2012 are the ones that would have been applied or sought for either right before or during the 2008 and 2009 economic downturn.
Okay.
And so this would have been a time when many companies were really seriously reevaluating what they needed to patent. And so there was a number of high-value patents coming from, for example, companies like Roush that have long had a history in the auto supply chain but are now recently diversifying into medical devices, life sciences equipment that serves the healthcare industry. Delphi has also been innovating in that area for the last several years. There's been a number of high-value innovations coming out of alternative energy, alternatives to the standard forms of fuel consumption that we know aren't always going to be sustainable going forward. That these are areas where companies are looking to the future because they need to. The world has changed, and they need to change with it.
I'm speaking with Chad Halcombe, who's a reporter for Crain's Detroit Business, and we're looking at Crain's new list of Michigan's 100 most innovative businesses. So, Chad, let's break this list down for a little bit for everyone. Geographically, where are most of these businesses located?
Well, that was one of the biggest surprises for us. We were expecting a lot of auto supply chain companies, a lot of companies in the university research corridor towns like Ann Arbor and East Lansing to be powerhouses of patents. And they are. They do generate a large number of them. But what was unique is the number that are coming from the west side of the state, from northern Michigan, from a lot of startups that are doing things in very non-traditional industries for this state and are breaking new ground. One of our top valued patent holders is in Petoskey, a company that is developing a new form of converting the methane product of natural gas drilling into a liquid form, which can then be sold as a biofuel. This isn't really something you necessarily think of in Michigan, although Michigan does have a lot of natural gas drills in the north half of the state.
Sure.
But it's an area where one company is staking out a high-value form of innovation. That's something no one's really trying or has really made a lot of progress in yet. And so while Gas Technologies, the company in Petoskey, doesn't have a lot of patents in the 2003 issuances, they only had three, but they were all very high-value patents just by virtue of the area they're carving out, the market they're seeking. No one's really doing that here.
What about the other geographic trends you're seeing, such as West Michigan? Is it generous tax breaks? What's going on there?
Well, some of that is the usual suspects. I mean, one big patent powerhouse on the west side of the state is Whirlpool, a major appliance company. They sought 135. They had 135 patents issued in 2012, as did Dow in Midland. That was also a big volume innovator. But Whirlpool did have a pretty high value index amongst the patents that it sought, as it's also trying to adapt to a new economy. There are a lot of manufacturers are looking for or retooling and getting into advanced materials manufacturing, one of those areas that economists and experts have targeted as a possible growth market within the U.S. more than traditional old-line manufacturing might be. This was a direction manufacturers were taking largely during the downturn as a way to diversify. And now, by now, with the 3 to 5 year lag time you see from the patent application to patent issuance process, that investment they were making back then is beginning to pay off. We saw a number of value patents coming also out of East Lansing, either from Michigan State or from some Michigan State commercial spin-out companies. Stryker, a healthcare company in the Kalamazoo area, is also a big patent innovator and also benefiting from that large investment companies are wanting to make in a growth market here in Michigan in healthcare. And there are a number of small startups in small towns like the Petoskey company. There are a number of Magna subsidiaries in Holland and Zeeland that have been doing a lot of inventing that gave the patent valuation firm a little bit of a pause, a moment to look at them for their high value as well. It really has been spread out around the state in a way that surprised us.
Is there something that these communities that you were talking about, Holland and Zeeland, certainly the university areas, Ann Arbor and East Lansing, what can they teach other parts of the state about attracting these innovative, creative companies?
Well, that's an interesting question. This was always, we think, and we're still evaluating this trend, but that there used to be a sort of barrier to entry for some of these smaller communities because they were geographically removed from universities that could provide them some talent or support, or from large corporate neighbors in the area that could potentially be interested in and invest in their technology. But with the arrival of the internet and new media, and it's becoming such an increasingly interconnected world, these small towns might not be as isolated in an information and innovation sense as they used to be. Mm. We think that's part of what's driving this, but we're going to need to do more research on that subject.
What does this list that Crain's has put together, the 100 most innovative companies in Michigan, what do you think, Chad, it tells us about the future of Michigan's economy and also the future of jobs in our state?
Well, as I was saying earlier, the value of a company is the value of its intellectual property in many ways, especially for startup and early stage companies that are just beginning to receive investment and starting to grow. This is probably what the most telling thing a list or an evaluation project like this can do for us is tell us what companies are likely to be suiting buyers or courting buyers in the coming months or years, things that might become attractive investments for private equity or venture capital firms, companies that look like they might have the most growth potential because their patent and their patent value makes them attractive as an area for more traditional companies to grow and diversify by taking in a new company into its R&D operation. Sometimes this is a great way to expand for companies that are looking for new markets. So these are the hot items on the market, even if some of them aren't necessarily selling. It does tell us some of the places where investors are looking.
Chad Holcomb is a reporter for Crain's Detroit, speaking to us about the 100 most innovative companies in Michigan. And Chad joined us from their offices in Detroit. Good to talk with you, Chad.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up for the hour, this bit of news. The state of Michigan is loosening its no smoking rules at some restaurants and bars. As Lester Graham reports, smoking outdoors will now be allowed under certain circumstances.
Ever since Ember's Bar and Grill in Tecumseh added an outdoor patio earlier this year, patrons who smoke have asked if they can light up. Sam Van Sickle is the general manager, and he's always had to explain they can't allow it.
Because it's the law. Wherever we're licensed to sell food or alcohol, we're not allowed to allow smoking.
But a clarification in the state's no smoking rule will now allow smoking outdoors as long as servers don't have to wait on people in the smoking area.
As long as I have a self-serve deck, you can stand out there, you can have a beer with your friends, and smoke a pack of cigarettes. You're more than welcome to do that.
Business owners can determine for themselves whether to limit it to certain hours or whether to allow smoking at all in their outdoor venues. Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
But the Michigan Restaurant Association says it does not expect many establishments to allow smoking in outdoor areas. It says cutting food and beverage services in those spaces would be just too costly for most restaurants. Michigan's smoking ban went into effect in May of 2010. We would love to hear from you. What do you think about loosening of Michigan's smoking ban? Is it good? Is it bad? I can certainly remember the legislature hotly debating the issue just a few years ago. Let us know your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and you can always find us on the website. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and April Van Buren. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for listening.